Hey, I'm Scott. Boy, I just got great news. I don't think I can tell you what it is, though, but cool, yes. I accept your offer, sir. You know who you are if you're listening. The rest of you, I'm not talking to you. Anyway, welcome to the show. I appreciate y'all tuning in. It's Friday, right? Yeah. Thank goodness. Sheldon Richmond is going to be on the show. I love Sheldon Richmond. He's about as libertarian as hell, man. He's as libertarian as he can possibly be. He's the editor of The Future of Freedom, which is the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. And I think you should subscribe to it because it's awesome. And anyway, he's going to talk about World War I on the show today. He's got a couple of recent articles about World War I. And today's is great. And, well, all articles about World War I, at least between the lines, are about why you should hate Woodrow Wilson so very much. Since he's the worst person who ever lived in the world. And, yeah, worse than Mao because he's Mao's daddy. So, worse than Mao. And anyway... So, Chairman Wilson, who destroyed America forever, who destroyed the world forever, who arranged the killing of, I don't know, 250 million people in the 20th century. Yeah, well, anyway, he's kind of an important historical figure. And Sheldon Richmond's article today is, well, I don't want to spoil it for you. It's at fff.org. You can spoil it for yourself if you want. I'm going to interview him about it and about another recent article he wrote about World War I. And then I'm also going to open up the phones because, hey, it's Friday. TGIF, the goal is freedom. That's Sheldon's Friday column. Kind of a pun there. I know you get it. But yeah, so wouldn't that be cool? Do a little bit of a call-in show. I usually tell all my interviewees, yeah, it's just you and me, no calls, that kind of thing. But then again, you know, hey, I don't know, it's Friday. Maybe we should do a call-in show. And Sheldon Richmond, what's good about him is he's good on everything, I think. Yeah, pretty sure he's good on everything. And so we're going to start off about World War I, and then ask him about that, or you could ask him about any of a lot of things going on. If you're in the chat room, maybe you can suggest to me what a real professional radio show host would do in this situation as far as, you know, coming up with good bait to get people to call in for the guests, that kind of thing. I don't know. I never really do that. But here's what I do know. There are major, important, humongous foreign policy things going on, and I know Sheldon's good on them all, so you could ask him anything that you wanted about at least what should America's position be on what's going on in Eastern Europe and across the Middle East, and probably, for that matter, Africa and Asia and the rest of it, too. So there's that, and then there's all the civil liberty stuff. There's the police state raging in Missouri and the other 49 states. And plenty to talk about with Sheldon Richmond. So I do hope you guys will call in and help make that a cool thing. That's coming up in an hour from now. And then also, I got Eric Garris is going to try to get Jason Ditz on the show to talk about Ukraine again. Because we've got major news coming out of Ukraine. And, well, he's real good on that. And I accidentally slept in a little bit and didn't prepare much of a show today. So... But that's going to be pretty cool, right? And, you know, I swear I've been emailing the hell out of some guests to try to come on to talk about Palestine right now, and I just have had the worst luck this week. I've just got a bunch of no's. And you know what it is? It's all real polite stuff of people saying, you know what? I'm on a writing deadline here, and I just can't do it. I'm sorry. I've gotten that from a lot of people. A lot of people got a lot to write about on the subject of Palestine, it turns out. So they can't do the show because they're on a damn deadline. Well, so that's problematic. But you know who's good on Palestine? Sheldon. So we could talk with Sheldon about that too. All right. Now, so I want to talk today for the rest of this segment and start out the show, maybe next segment too here, to talk about what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri here. Now, they've got Ron Johnson. He's the captain of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. He's giving a talk now. They're saying, basically, there was no police riot last night. And someone wrote in the chat room this morning, hey, man, they did exactly what you said to do. Isn't that cool? It is exactly what I said to do 2 days ago. I said, you know, if I was the governor or if a decent man was the governor, and I don't know exactly the law in Missouri, maybe he would have to go to the attorney general or even to the legislature, but being the governor, he probably has it within his own authority, to simply call the local jurisdictions back and replace them with the state police and give an order, slacks and shirts. Yesterday, I added you can wear body armor, a bulletproof vest under your shirt. None of this military fatigue stuff at all. But I said that 2 days ago, too. 3 days ago. Yeah, because today's Friday. 3 days ago. And then yesterday, I also added, only pistols and handguns, shotguns in your trunk for an absolute emergency only. Otherwise, stand there and be a nice guy. All militarism completely pulled out of the field. And you put the cops on the corner to say, hi, protesters, I'm only here to protect your right to protest. Have a nice day. And then that's it. And it's simple, because all the escalation, of course, including all the rioting and everything that happened, was all the police's fault. It was all the reaction to their riot. And they were so out of line that every expert on CNN agrees. I mean, you got the most militarist, right-wing, jackboot jerk-offs on all of CNN saying, yes, you know, the police are way out of line here. Because they were way out of line. And then, so what I said, and I characterized my own answer as, not even the libertarian answer. This could be the conservative Republican answer. This could be the liberal Democrat answer. This is just the plain old American answer. This is just the plain old decent thing to do. If you're the governor of Missouri, you pull back the local police who are escalating and escalating and escalating the situation that they started with the killing of a man on his knees with his hands up. And you just put out guys with shirts and slacks. And this is how all American policing should be. I mean, I'm not even for American policing at all. I would recommend a piece by my friend Anthony Gregory at Mises.org against police socialism. We don't rely on socialism to make sure we have enough fruits and vegetables in the market. It's the market that provides for fruits and vegetables at the market. Why should security services be any different? It shouldn't. You don't need a state. That's the big myth. You need some socialist state even to protect the market. It's stupid and ridiculous. It's just not true. But as far as all of us being saddled with these cops, they ought to not be dressed and armed and trained like soldiers. They ought to be like Don Knotts with their little revolver in case of an absolute emergency, and that's it. And you can kill a man with a 38, okay? Certainly, you know, fine. They want a Glock 9mm, fine. But other than that, and I'm being very generous. Other than that, my solution for Ferguson, which was in fact implemented. Go back and check the record of the archives. Was in fact implemented 2 days later by the governor of Missouri. Has worked. And now here's the rub. It's worked for their interest too. Now, instead of the cops being the evil stormtroopers of death, now they have a very nice, friendly, respectful black face on the police. This guy, Ron Johnson, is the Barack Obama of Missouri right now, coming and telling you that George Bush imperialism is not so bad because look at the new marketing shtick that we came up for it. Same thing here. It's good that they de-escalated and people are not being hurt. I'm not saying that. I'm not opposing that. It was my idea in the first place, my recommendation in the first place. Not that they listened to me, but obviously it was just the right thing to do. But there is the negative consequence of this, that the state police then look legitimate by comparison in a way that may undercut the overall argument for real reform here. And now we got to go to break. Back in just a second. Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oops. Not close enough. So, what I was talking about there at the end of the break was that there's a little bit of a problem with the state police taking over, even though it was my recommendation. I want to see anybody else killed. Did anybody want to see anybody else killed? So it's good, but then it's the good cop, bad cop thing, where, in fact, all police in Missouri are an occupying army, and the poorest, and typically, that also, you know, you can, Venn diagram, you can overlay race and class and all that pretty easily, and so poor, politically powerless people, and especially ones of racial minorities, they get the brunt of it. Rand Paul, whoever Ghost wrote his article in Time magazine, said it perfect, that, you know, when things are this bad, it's still the people who are the poorest and the racial minorities who take the brunt of it the worst. And, you know, man, by the way, did you guys see this great video? I don't know who this guy is, because, you know what, I still just listen to Public Enemy and whatever. No, I like Immortal Technique. That's new stuff that I listen to, relatively new, last, you know, decade. Stuff that's come out since I was a little kid. But anyway, so there's this guy who did this video called Call the Cops. And, you know, if you can stand angry rap music at all, or if you like it especially, I don't know how good it is musically, whatever. I'm not much of a critic about that. But I liked it, and it was okay. And then content-wise, it's just great, man. It's not even Call the Cops. The whole thing is, this is what happens when you call the cops. It's by Rob Hussle. Here it is. Rob Hussle. I don't know who that is, but anyway. And it's a great video. They got all the best stock footage of cops beating the crap out of people and killing people from the last, say, I don't know, 5-6 years. And they collaged the hell out of it. It matches up perfect. I mean, in real fast pace, you know, and matches up with what he's saying just perfect. And it's great. And one of the things I was going to say in there is, you notice a lot of the victims in there are white. White people aren't protected from this either. You know, obviously, the more wealth you have, the more access to the protection of the law, if you can call it that, you might get. But, hey, there are a lot of poor white people, too. There are a lot of all kinds of people of all kinds of races who are treated like, you know, Untermenschen by our so-called public servants. And I really like this video because it's, you know, the Lawnmower Man or something, where he's just blasting this stuff into your eye holes. And it makes it very clear that we do live in an authoritarian police state, that our government, our legislators have passed laws mandating that our police are trained to treat us as foreign enemies, to kill us at the first opportunity. Even your mom or your grandma, they get pulled over on the side of the road for a turn signal violation or whatever. They're as likely as anyone to have the cops scream in their face like a drill sergeant or a Nazi or whatever, and treat them with absolutely no dignity whatsoever over the slightest of infraction, and maybe much, much worse. You know, the difference between white people and black people on this issue now is that many white people are still under some illusion that the police are there to protect them. So they continue to make the horrible mistake of calling the stormtroopers of death on themselves and suffering the brunt of their rage. Come and protect me, because I still believe, because I saw it so many times on TV, that somehow you guys are the good guys, and that you guys are here to protect me from the terrible thing that I'm afraid of. And then they come, and the cops just unleash hell. The saddest ones are parents are having a hard time with their teenage son. He's having a really hard time right now. And him and the old man got in a fight in the yard, and the son took off, and the mom panicked and called 911, and then the cops come and kill him. And that happens all the time. Sometimes the kid has a real problem, right? He's got, like, bipolar to the nth degree, and he's really having a freak out, and he's armed with a knife, but 911 operator, please jot this down. It's just a butter knife. He's just 14. This happened in Williamson County right off of El Salido and 620 in Anderson Mill neighborhood a few years back. It's just a butter knife. Please don't, you know, overreact. But it was the mom who called them. So the cops just came and killed him. They just came and killed him. He wasn't anywhere near them. Like, he's gonna, what, kill them with a butter knife? Whatever, whatever. You don't even have to pretend that they need an excuse. It's completely out of control. The difference between white people and black people on this issue is black people know better. Black people are terrified of the police. You know, I've said this a million times, but it's true. It's a real story. Happened to me. I had young black kids in my tax cab. We're driving down Rosewood Avenue, and the kid, I think he was 11 years old. Because I remember telling the story that way, so I think that must have been the fact I was referring to in the first place anyway. And he said, my grandmama taught me, the cops pull you over, you put your hands out the window. Because they'll kill you. They will kill you. Now, when I was a kid, I learned, well, you keep your hands on the steering wheel because you don't want to make a cop nervous. You want him to be able to see your hands. Black children are taught by their grandmamas, you put your hands out the window. You, in body language, beg and plead, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. We all know you can and get away with it, but please, please don't. I'm no threat. Or they'll kill you. They will kill you. And in Austin, Texas, hunting black men is just a sport for the police department here. Since the year 2000, there must be 25, 30, I don't know, 50 of them. Dead, rotting corpses in the ground because the APD got their hands on them. It got so bad, I'm starting to think the crime is being unarmed. Maybe all black men ought to carry Glocks. And maybe when police initiate deadly force against them, they ought to defend their lives with the only chance they've got. I mean, hell, they'll, you know, probably get the death penalty for defending themselves anyway. But then at least they'll be able to suffer in a cage for a while first, instead of just lying down dead on the side of the road or in a ditch at Shoal Creek and 34th Street. You know, I don't know, man. I mean, I don't want to see anybody shoot anybody, but I'm just saying that that's the reality in the United States of America, especially for black men fighting aged males. And, you know, I don't know, man. It seems actually sending in this guy Ron Johnson is a really smart PR move from a counterinsurgency point of view. You keep ratcheting this thing up and ratcheting it up and ratcheting it up, you might find out that these people actually do have firearms in their houses, and actually they're going to go and get them now. Let's hope that somehow they can make themselves, and I mean the very least powerful of them, politically, but say, I don't know, the favorite matriarchs and patriarchs of the community, that they can make themselves the new prosecutors and new police chiefs. But now I'm pipe dreaming. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, y'all, welcome back. Cool, man. So, I'm going to interview this guy, Carl Van Wolferen, who's a Dutch journalist who wrote this thing that was published at UNS.com. Man, I didn't really, you know, take a bunch of notes or anything. I guess the major themes in it are, first of all, just the overall media narrative and how ridiculous it is about America's relationship with Russia and what's going on in Ukraine. And then he gets into some of the specifics about the plane being shot down and what happened there and some other things. And so, yeah, I'll have to study up at one of these long breaks at the top of the hour here. Make sure I have my act together for that interview. Great. But that means also I can save the Ukraine news for that interview. So that's good. Oh, so I guess that means maybe I don't need Jason on the show today. Anyway. Well, anyway, so we're going to work it out. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. And by the way, it is fun drive time on the show. I know everybody's doing their summer fun drive, and I know everybody's wasting all their money on trying to go on vacation for a little while with their family and don't have any money to spare. And I know that we're living through a bust disguised as a boom right now, and with a further bust coming, and everything sucks for everyone, not just me. However, I need your money. You have to give some of it to me, or else there can't be a show anymore. The best way that you could do that would be to hire me to do ads for you. If you want to advertise on the show, pay me a pittance, man. I charge so little, you have no idea. And then I will tell people to buy your stuff or support your group or whatever the hell it is. Okay, so my email address is scott@scotthorton.org. And then also, I'll take donations. And people who sign up for the monthly donations of $5, $10, $20, all those, absolutely great. I appreciate it so much. You have no idea. And the one-time donations of $5, $10, $20, and more dollars, those are great too. And some people send more. If you send $100 or more, I'll send you a commodity disc, which I think is ought to be, other than Bitcoins, but of course they're exchangeable for Bitcoins too. But I just think this is the greatest idea for a currency in the history of mankind. It's a silver coin, a pure element, and it's pretty. And industrially useful and will always have some value to mankind. Unless, I guess, if some magic element making machine comes out at some point, it'll make, you know, drive down the price. But anyway, it's a pretty damn good silver dollar. Right now they're trading for about, what, 20, 25 bucks, something like that. But what's cool about it is it has this QR code on the back, so you get the instant spot price. You know how much the coin is worth in real time, that instant, all the time. And so, what a perfect way to have a silver currency. And I think Arlo Pignatti's really got his act together in being the first out of the gate with this. I think it's great. It's at commoditydiscs.com and at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. If you donate 100 bucks or more to the Scott Horton Show, which would be really nice, then I will send you one in the mail. There are quite a few out in the mails as we speak. Well, as you listen and I speak. So anyway, and I'm sorry, man, I don't want this to sound like NPR. But then again, if it's legitimate for NPR to go on and on with their whining asses about how badly they need your money so they can produce a bunch of crap, then it ought to be okay for me to say, hey, listen, those of you who like the show, you know there's nothing compares to it. So if you want it to keep existing, then suggested donation at the door is whatever you think it's worth to you, man. And whatever you can do. Okay, cool. That's all I got to say about that. Sorry. Now back to the Ferguson thing here. All the news this morning is that the young man, Mike Brown, may have not just shoplifted, but may have actually robbed the Quickie Mart and used force to get out. Now there's a discrepancy. I pointed out on Twitter the shorts, but I corrected myself that actually in a couple of those frames of the video I've seen now, it looks like, yeah, no, maybe this could be tan shorts, just in shadow in some of the frames rather than dark shorts. So maybe, but it seems like his shoes don't match. It really looks like he's wearing sandals in the still footage from the market and sneakers while he's laying dead in the street. That's kind of strange. I don't really know if that's much of a discrepancy. Maybe it really is him. I'm saying he forced his way out. Now, that changes the story a little bit because it means that rather than the story beginning, assuming that this is all true and that the cops aren't just making up the whole damn story, who knows? But assuming the truth of that, it means that the cops would have had a reason to stop them other than just black kids walking in the street and he felt like picking a fight with them, which was, you know, the narrative, first of all. And I remember hearing somebody said something about a shoplifting back at the beginning, and then that kind of got washed away in the story, and then it turned into they were walking while black was their crime kind of a thing. So anyway, and someone sent a thing to me earlier where the courts have ruled that a fleeing felon can be shot if he's wanted for a felony, and a robbery would count as a felony. And if the cop has reasonable belief or whatever threshold that that is, in fact, the person that he's chasing. However, even according to, well, I guess, I don't know if the cops have conceded this, but according to, I think, multiple witnesses, certainly at least his friend says that the cop shot him in the back, perhaps twice, and that he then turned and put his hands up. I don't remember now. Chat room guys, you remember if they say on his knees or just standing there with his hands up and said, I'm unarmed, please don't shoot or stop shooting or something like that. And then the cop went bang, 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 kept shooting him, finished him off after he was already shot and surrendered, finished him off. First degree, well, second degree murder. Right there. If that's true, and the forensics will prove it, assuming the forensics aren't, you know, tainted. But if he was shot in the back twice, and then he turned around and said, don't shoot him unarmed, and the cop kept shooting him, blam. That's 2 weeks paid vacation for you, buddy. That would be the worst punishment a cop could possibly get for a second degree murder rap. So, if it's true that he, you know, tried to shoplift but then actually used force in order to successfully escape the market, then that would give, and there's a 911 call to that effect and whatever, that would give the cop more of a justification for the stop in the first place. But then again, the witness says he grabbed him around the throat out of the window of the car. Now, I don't think any of us believe for a moment that the kid reached for the cop's gun. Give me a break. That's such a stupid lie. I think they even quit trying to tell that lie. But if the cop, originally, the first thing he does is apply deadly force to this kid, you know, strangle him to death or, you know, strangle him at all, at that point, I believe even a fleeing felon would have the right to at least attempt to get away, if not defend his own life. Just because you're a suspected wanted felon does not mean the cop has a right to strangle you to death. So, even then. But don't worry, I'm sure all the conservatives, I just saw Ben Swan tweet out, the Ku Klux Klan, they're raising money for the cop. I'm sure there are a lot of people on the right in America going to follow the KKK's lead on this. Oh, come on. White cop shot a black kid. He must have had it coming somehow, right? Like an Arab when they get exploded. Everybody knows that, you know, I don't know. It's probably because they deserved it or something. Right, conservatives? Or will you abandon conservative? Whoops. Conservatism. And become a decent person. I saw a black conservative talking like the Klan on TV about this case yesterday. I think on MSNBC. Shaking my head. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, I'm Scott. This is a dang thing here, man. ScottHorton.org is my site. Keep all my interview archives there. Yes, more than 3,500 of them, or 33 or 34 or something, 100 of them now. Going back to 2003. Listen, let me go ahead and give out the phone number now and start writing it down. And hell, you can call in and talk this segment if you want. The phone number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. We had an 800 number, but then that was too expensive and not worth it and whatever. So, well, whatever. It's free on your cell phone. Or, yeah, anyway. 512-271-4836. You can talk to me about this Ferguson thing. If you want to say something about that, you can talk about... oops, am I not logged in here? You could talk about, obviously, Ukraine, Gaza, the caliphate, whatever you're interested in. I think I really got to get out of the habit of calling it Iraq. Iraq is over, dude. Iraq ain't coming back. Oh, man, I got to talk about that Reuters Iraq story. Let me write this down so I don't forget. In fact, I should talk about that now. No, I should talk about Ukraine now, man. Did you see what's going on in Ukraine right now? I mean, I don't know. All I know is what they're saying is going on in Ukraine right now, but Reuters Iraq story. Okay, listen. This is the latest bad news out of Ukraine right here, man. The Guardian, Ukraine says it has destroyed Russian vehicles that entered its territory. So the background of this is that the Russians want to send in all these white-painted trucks full of, they said, humanitarian supplies, and they negotiated it through the Red Cross. But the Russians and the Ukrainians never talked, only through the Red Cross. And so it wasn't quite finalized. And now that Ukraine... neo-Nazi coup d'etat government in Kiev, sponsored by the United States of America, is saying that it has destroyed Russian vehicles that entered eastern Ukraine. Guardian.com. Oh, it's theguardian.com. I thought it was guardian.co.uk. What the hell happened to that? Ukraine claims to have destroyed Russian military vehicles in the country's east, a day after a column was spotted moving across the border. Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, told David Cameron in a phone call Friday that a column, that's the prime minister of Britain, in a phone call on Friday that a column of Russian armored vehicles had been destroyed. Russia has denied the vehicles were even in Ukraine. Does that mean they've also denied that they were destroyed? A statement from Poroshenko's office said, quote, the president informed Cameron that the information was trustworthy because the majority of those machines, Russian military vehicles, had been eliminated by the Ukrainian artillery at night. You know what? I don't think that's true. That doesn't sound true to me. They eliminate a bunch of vehicles with artillery at night? That's the part where it falls apart to me, that the Ukrainian government did that. Who did that? The right sector Nazis aimed artillery at vehicles and hit them? It added, the president expressed concern over the situation on the border, particularly over the fact that the inflow of Russian arms and military machines in Ukraine through the open part of the border continued. The Guardian and Telegraph reported on Thursday that correspondents had seen 23 armored personnel carriers supported by fuel trucks and other military logistics vehicles crossing into Ukrainian territory. It wasn't possible to verify the destination or ultimate fate of the convoy or monitor how long it stayed on the other side of the border. Separately, NATO said it had observed the Russian incursion. What we've seen last night is a continuation of what we've seen for some time, said Rasmussen, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the head of NATO. That's the American Mutual Assured Destruction Treaty Alliance in Europe. Britain has summoned the Russian ambassador in London over the incursion. A spokesman for Cameron said he had expressed grave concerns at reports of Russian military vehicles crossing the border. They agreed that humanitarian aid does need to reach those in the east, but this should be delivered through the International Red Cross. Russia should be cooperating fully. Yeah, yeah. America can go in with bombs. Even this very week, in the name of humanitarianism. But Russia must not aggress against Ukraine by bringing actual humanitarian aid to the people in the east. Anyway, yeah, you know, I'm sure hoping this guy's a good interview later. He wrote this great article, Carl Van Wolferen. He's Dutch, and knows a hell of a lot about this stuff. I really hope that he can really help inform our perspective about what's going on right now. You know, I saw an article, John Walsh wrote a thing that I guess we're going to blog at antiwar.com here in a minute or something, where he shows a headline from RT, I think it was from RT, where they're saying Russian rebel group offers ceasefire to spare more humanitarian, worse humanitarian catastrophe. Something along those lines. And we don't even get to hear about that. I want to make sure and ask this guy. Hey, is it true that the rebels have been begging for a ceasefire or asking for one? Because that's certainly not part of the story that we would ever hear on TV here in America, you know? Anyway, that's coming up. I don't know exactly what's the truth of what's going on here. But you could see how... Now, let's do a little fun thought experiment. What if, say, for example, it is just food aid, and it's really true that the Ukrainian government really did blast these guys, and then, what, killed a bunch of civilians? Bringing food aid? Or worse, killed a bunch of Russian military men? Bringing food aid? And then what's Putin supposed to do? Sit back and take it? And then for how long? Let him do it how many more times? Before Putin will have to actually go ahead and bring tanks across the border and say what? And we are talking about Russia. It's not the USSR, but they have an army, and it knows how to kill people, and a hell of a lot better than the Ukrainian army does. And we got right now Republicans pushing to make Ukraine officially a non-NATO ally. Sorry, my hesitation is because I'm writing this down, so I remember for later. They want to make it officially a non-NATO ally of the United States. Which I think counts for like India and Pakistan and or Australia, right? Australia, they're a member of the Commonwealth, but they're not a member of NATO. The British, a.k.a. American Commonwealth Empire. Non-NATO ally. On the order of Australia? Ukraine, really, our ally. Or us, theirs. And are we really their ally when we overthrow their elected government and install a Nazi regime in its place and then back their declaration of war against those in the East who would dare to resist? You say we're pro somebody, but it doesn't sound like we're pro Ukraine. Pro the Social National Party. No, really, I swear to God, they're called the Social National Party. Oh, no, we changed our name. Now we're the Freedom Party. Really, the Social Nationalists. And not just are they, you know, wannabe Nazi types. They really trace their lineage directly back to the Ukrainian SS brigades that served Hitler in the Holocaust in Ukraine. They are the Proud Banderists. That's what they're called. Named after Stepan Bandera, who served Hitler. They walk around with their Wolfsengel, which is like a capital N with a vertical line through the middle of it. And that's their version of the swastika that they wore on their armbands, that they still wear on their armbands. In honor of those who wore those armbands serving Hitler in World War II. And not just fighting against the Soviets, because what the hell? If you're in this country or that, you know, and the Nazis and the Soviet armies are going head-to-head, whose side do you choose? There are a lot of variables at play there, you know, if you have a choice at all, I mean. But anyway, no, they actually did pogroms against Jewish civilians, thousands of them, and against Poles, too. So, there you go. These are their proud heirs. The Banderist militias. That's who America's backing in Kiev. And then what if Russia crosses the border and starts a war? And what if Kiev keeps fighting? And then what if Russia whoops their ass and takes Odessa or more? Then what? We go to war with Russia for Ukraine? For a Nazi government? Our government installed in power in Kiev? Is this crazy? This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, welcome back to the show, y'all. We got Shell the Richmond on the line. He's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation and the editor of their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom. That's at fff.org/subscribe. And welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Always glad to be with you. Hope you're doing fine, too.
I am. I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. And appreciate you writing about World War One, because even though it's a long time ago, 100 years, we're right around the anniversary now of the beginning of it. And even though it pales in comparison in death toll and in, printed words about it compared to World War II, it is generally agreed it's the genesis of World War II, even if it's not very well understood itself. And so you've got a couple of articles here. The latest one is Liberty in America During the Great War. So I guess I'd like to start with that, because that's another very important untold story of, the revolution within the form here in America during the Great War. But then we could also talk about your article from the 8th, the 100th anniversary of the Great State Crime. You can mix it all together and answer however you want, but I guess I'll just ask it really broadly. Would you please tell us about your theses here and the points you're trying to make? And then also I'll go ahead and note now that later on in the show, in fact, sooner or later, I don't care, we'd like to take y'all's calls for Sheldon Richmond, too, about World War One and or pretty much any of the other wars or whatever y'all want to talk about. The number here is 512-271-4836. So if y'all want to start lining up, that's okay. So go ahead, I guess, and first of all, talk about what the war meant for the form of the government here in the United States.
Sure. Excuse me there. Swallowed incorrectly. Bad timing.
Well, you got two tubes there, one for breathing and one for drinking, and you got to not switch them up.
I got them mixed up. So, yes, the World War One is really, truly a watershed. for the United States, for Europe, for the world. It changed so much. It set so much in motion. And to this day, we're still suffering.
All right, you know what? I'll tell you what. I'm going to talk for a second, and I'm going to go ahead and mute your mic so you can go ahead and just clear your throat as bad as you need to, and then I'll turn it back on in about 5 seconds. So there's Sheldon on mute. I'm talking with Sheldon Richmond. He needs to clear his throat pretty bad. Poor guy. I asked him to talk for 10 minutes the next six, whatever's left of this segment after that long intro, and poor guy could barely get a word out without choking. So I think he's probably clear now. How you doing, Sheldon?
We're good, I think.
Okay, I'm sorry. There you go. Go ahead.
I'm in the back of an ambulance now being rushed to the emergency room, but I'll just keep talking.
No. Okay, good. Yeah, well, we would expect nothing less from you.
So it was really a watershed. That can be a cliche. A lot of things are called watersheds, which may not be, but I think World War One really deserves it. It changed the world, the United States as well, so completely, and we still suffer consequences today. And if anybody wants evidence, just look at the front page of almost any newspaper. The Middle East is still writhing under the decisions that were made mainly by the British and the French in 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and in the early 20s when they created countries out of, just by drawing lines in the sand, literally, without regard to who they were grouping together in these new artificial countries, despite the fact that there might have been, differing sex, ethnic groups, tribes, et cetera, and also dividing those entities with these artificial lines so that you would have a single tribe, part of a single tribe on two sides of a border that Churchill or somebody drew. So yeah, we still haven't gotten over it, and I think it'll be quite a while before we do. In the United States, Murray Rothbard has a classic essay called World War One as Fulfillment, The Intellectuals in Power, mm-hmm. and he points out how the progressives, certainly the Eastern progressives, it's hard to talk about the progressives because there really were subdivisions. The Midwestern, Western progressives were different from the Eastern progressives in many ways. And when Wilson publicly changed his views on the war, don't forget he gets reelected in 1916 bragging that he kept us out of war. The war, of course, started in 1914, like you said, 100 years ago. So he kind of turns around. Excuse me, I'm not even fully recovered.
No, that's all right. Go ahead. Here, I'll stall for time and mute you here. Go ahead and cough and choke. I'm talking with Sheldon Richmond, and right now, y'all, I'm posting on Twitter a link. Well, here in just a second, I'll be posting a link to that great article that Sheldon's referring to here by Murray Rothbard, World War One as Fulfillment, Power in the Intellectuals. I love reading Rothbard, man. He's great. This is at Mises.org. And well, there's the, oh, no, that's the PDF. Well, let me find the HTML file for you here. I think we got it here. No. Anyway, Sheldon, are you breathing? How you doing now?
I am back. I could only find a PDF also. But anyway,
Here it is at archive.lewrockwell.com. I've got the HTML, so it's on my Twitter, y'all. I'll post it in just a sec. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
When Wilson becomes pro-war in 1917 and decides America has to get into it, he might have always, you know, believed that. But told the public in 1916 that we wouldn't be getting involved, but maybe he always wanted to. But once the election's behind him, 1917 comes along, and he decides, no, we need to get into it. Now, you know, things have happened, too. Germany starts up again. It's submarine warfare. Wilson was taking the position that, you know, even if civilians are on ships with Americans are on ships with loaded with munitions that almost said with musicians, but with munitions, you know, they ought to be able to have absolute safety on the high seas. And so, you know, this is one of the ultimatums he threw at Germany when Germany was using unrestricted submarine warfare, which I'm not defending. But the point is, Wilson was looking for a way to get into the war and was, you know, backing England quietly. And so taking a consistently anti-German stance. And so when Germany restarts the submarine warfare, and also there's this Zimmermann telegram, which is exposed where you know, the Germans were in contact with the Mexicans saying if Mexico helps out and America loses the war, then you know, the Mexico can get some of its territory back that was taken, I guess Texas mainly. So I guess you would be living in Mexico right now, Scott.
Right, which is, I think it's worth, you know, emphasizing there that that's the thinnest pretext for war in the last 100 years, too, including Korea, Vietnam, baiting Saddam into invading Kuwait and the rest of them. Oh, Germany is going to help Mexico reconquer the Southwest, huh? Yeah, give me a break. I mean, that is the dumbest pretext. That is the stupidest Gulf of Tonkin resolution I've ever heard of in my life.
So it was enough for Wilson to be able to stir up war fever. I don't think it took a whole lot of persuasion for the American people to get on board. The book I relied on for the current article, the one that runs today about civil liberties during the war, was written by Donald M. Kennedy. It's called Over Here. Subtitle, First World War and American Society. And his first chapter is about the winning of the American mind for war. And it doesn't seem like it took a lot of fighting to win the American mind for war. Americans are, you know, we like to think of them as sort of, you know, keep to themselves isolationists in spirit. But they, it doesn't take much to win them over. So I don't think Wilson needed much. The intellectuals, as Rothbard points out, especially the progressives now, were against the war in 1916, but when Wilson turned around, they backed Wilson.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think I remember, was even in House's papers that he had negotiated our entry into World War One back in 1915 before the re-election on the slogan "He kept us out of war." Anyway, we'll pick up on the other side of this break. We're talking World War I here and abroad with the great Sheldon Richman. And taking your calls here in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. This is the Scott Horton Show. It's fundraising week. I rarely do this, only when I really got to. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate if you like the show and you want to hear more of it. We're going to start taking calls for our guest, Sheldon Richman, in just a couple of minutes here at 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Right now we're talking about World War I. We can also open up to broader subjects here. But we're talking about how Wilson lied us into war, and Sheldon was describing some of the effects that policy had, for example, in turning the Middle East over to the British and the French, for one thing. And then we were talking about progressive and really popular support for the war, whether they were lied into it or not. They were happy to be, kind of like at least half of Americans back in 2002. And the article today, again, at fff.org, is Liberty in America During the Great War, Consequences for Individual Freedom and Advances in State Power Here at Home. But you know what, Sheldon? The front was way the hell over there between France and Germany. So what does that have to do with liberty here at home anyway, really? Other than the people being conscripted to go fight, obviously.
Well, once Wilson decides that he can now take the country into the war, he doesn't have to worry about re-election or anything. The progressives in the East, like John Dewey, jump on board. I guess they had been critical of getting in, but when Wilson came around, they came around. One of the great voices who was of that group, who then broke, is the great Randolph Bourne. Who coined the famous phrase, war is the health of the state. He condemned Dewey, who was sort of a mentor of his, and others like Herbert Crowley, the whole New Republic crowd, by the way, that were beating the drums for war. And he analyzed, what a bad mistake they were making, and history proves him right and the progressives wrong. What happened at home was, and this is where the whole idea of 100% American arises, I think the national security state begins before World War I. It doesn't begin after World War II. I think that's setting it way too late. The administration, and not just the administration, this was true at the grassroots as well, without direct links to the administration, wanted to stamp out any dissent. Anybody who was talking about how the war was not constitutional or how the draft was not constitutional got cracked down on. The Attorney General, Thomas Gregory of the United States, boasted that he had hundreds of thousands of people in the American Security League, I think it was called, who were out there helping the overworked feds sniff out any sign or any utterance of disloyalty. People were charged. This is when we get the Espionage Act, which Obama, of course, is still charging people, whistleblowers, under. We get that in 1917, and it is used against speech. The Postmaster General is using laws, wartime laws, censorship laws, to exclude magazines from the mail or remove their second class mailing permit, which hampered magazines. Even the New Republic at that point objected to what the administration was doing, even though they were pro-war. There was an all-out effort to stamp out anybody openly questioning the war or conscription. Of course, the conscription came in 1917. Eugene Debs, most famously perhaps, was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He didn't serve it because Harding pardoned him, but Wilson sentenced him to 10 years in prison for making a speech. He didn't urge anybody to violate the law like the draft law, so he didn't even do that. And I'm not saying that would justify prison imprisonment, but he did not do that. He simply critically analyzed the war and the draft, and he was sentenced, and the Supreme Court upheld the sentence, including the great civil libertarian, and of course I'm using that sarcastically, Oliver Wendell Holmes and Brandeis. Oliver Wendell Holmes during this era, in looking over espionage cases in 1919, right after the war, when they were reviewing cases that finally went up to them, that's when Holmes devises the clear and present danger test. You know, that if speech, which otherwise would be perfectly fine, he said, or perfectly legal, presents a clear and present danger to objectives of the country or the administration or the government, then Congress has the right to limit it and stop it and suppress it. And therefore they upheld cases where people were sentenced to prison merely for publishing or writing. So it changed America. Just the war changed America just as it changed the world. Rothbard's famous essay goes on to point out that progressives got into, you know, the government, of course, takes over the economy essentially when there's a world war going on. Thank goodness that sort of thing doesn't happen anymore. I mean, it's already heavily enough in the economy, but we you know, when we look at the two world wars, it basically nationalizes the whole economy. It's first claim on everything, manpower as well as materials. And this happened in World War One, and it gave progressive types hands-on experience running bureaucracies, you know, price administration boards, war industries board, all kinds of stuff. And they loved it. And they wanted to keep this thing going. Now, a lot of them didn't like war, and they thought you could have the moral equivalent of war. This is where this expression comes from. William James, actually, before World War One, but William James says, look, there are good things about war, the solidarity and, you know, the uniformity of thought, we're all pulling together, but isn't there a way we could do this without war? So progressives were, it's not that they loved war, they liked the collectivism that war gave us, and they liked the power that they got because they got to run important bureaus. And so they were hoping that once the war ended, they could still have all of that, although it wouldn't be wouldn't be for the sake of war. It would be for the normal course of running the economy and running the society. So it definitely changed America, just like it changed so much of the world.
Yeah, and really set the precedent for so much to come. You know, the whole New Deal is just a replication of the same thing.
That's right. Those same guys, same
dream
back.
Come true.
This is another thing that Rothbard points out. When the New Deal comes in with Roosevelt, a lot of those people, like Bernard Baruch, come back. They had neat jobs during World War One, during the 20s with the return to normalcy and you know, Harding and Coolidge. You didn't have that. There was no big, huge rollback, but there was no growth in it, really, and there might have been some marginal rollback under Coolidge, let's say. Harding didn't live that long. Mm-hmm. But once the New Deal came along, all those kinds of bureaus could be recreated, and there was the precedent for World War I, and a lot of the same people came back to run them, saying, "Oh, good, we're right, great. We weren't out of work for too long. We're back in the saddle." And
all right, now, definitely. I'm sorry, hold it right there for just a sec. We're about to have to go out to take this break here in just a sec. We already have three callers stacked up, so that'll be good for the next segment. Anybody else wants to call in? We're going to take calls for Sheldon Richman on World War One, or if you want to hear what he thinks about any other thing, too, I think that's fine. You know, Sheldon's good on everything. The number is 512-271-4836. You three guys already, guys and or gals online there, don't go away. We'll take your calls right when we get back. It's, again, Sheldon Richman from the Future Freedom Foundation. We're talking World War One, and I want to mention one more footnote here. I know he's a friend of yours. Joseph R. Stromberg has this. It's such a great piece. It's called Remembering with Astonishment, Woodrow Wilson's Reign of Terror in Defense of Freedom. And it's also at archive.lourockwell.com. You can search that up. Just put Remembering with Astonishment and Stromberg. It'll come right up, I guess. And now hold it right there, everybody. We're talking with Sheldon about his new article, Liberty in America During the Great War. And we'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. ScottHorton.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Right now, I'm talking World War One with Sheldon Richmond, but I'm also taking your calls at 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And we have a few people online. Sheldon, you ready to go ahead and start taking some calls?
Yes, I am.
And by the way, I already said that even though we're talking World War One, you people can talk about the empire at home or abroad, whatever you want to bring up, or especially try to keep it in the form of a question for Sheldon, but we're going to be broader than just World War One. But also, if you want to talk about World War One, that'd be great, too. Okay, so let's see here. First caller, you're on.
Hey, how's it going, Scott and Sheldon? Nice to talk to you.
Oh, man, your phone sounds terrible. Please back off the microphone just a little bit if you could.
Okay, how's that?
A bit better. Go ahead.
Okay, how you guys doing, Scott and Sheldon? It's great to talk to you. I was wondering, Sheldon, if you could comment on the industrialists and the bankers that were agitating for World War One to begin with, kind of pre the whole administration's effort to get us spun up into a war frenzy. If you could comment on, you know, the interactions between the banks here and the Bank of England, and why it was that the fascist industrialists of the era wanted us to get involved in the war in the first place.
Okay, great question. Great question, but horrible telephone. You need to go trade that thing in for the next generation. But go ahead, Sheldon. Were you able to hear that question?
Well, I didn't quite get it all. It was pretty scratched.
Okay. Yeah, it was pretty bad. The question was, could you please explain a little bit, talk about the relationship between the bankers and the industrialists in America who pushed for war before Woodrow Wilson really even had apparently made the call to definitely go that way, and their relationship with British bankers and that kind of thing.
Yeah, the story that that I've read many times over the years is that I think Morgan in particular, the Morgan interests in particular, had lent money to the British government and you know, wanted to make sure they got repaid. And I guess they figured if Britain lost the war, the prospects of getting repaid weren't very good. And so there was, you know, there was that the base of sympathy. I think there also was general sympathy among the elite for England, although, you know, there were a lot of German Americans in the United States. So the public at first, a lot of the public at first wasn't automatically anti-German, but Germans went from being a very respected, subgroup, German Americans, to being a despised group, like you mentioned. I think you mentioned that.
I guess, you know, really the establishment on Wall Street, there was a lot more class division back then, and it really was an Anglo elite that ruled at, for example, the Morgan Bank.
And after the war, the real power behind the Fed, who was Benjamin Strong, worked closely with the head of the Bank of England.
Montague
Norman, and that according to the Rothbard's version of things, that's what really started the motor that ended up in the Great Depression, because
the U.S.
was helping Britain get back on its pre-war sterling ratio, pound to the sterling, and so the U.S. was inflating to help them out. So, yes, there was definite sympathy for Britain and a desire to protect those loans, which is interesting because if in the Kennedy chapter that I referred to, the Donald Kennedy chapter, somebody got in trouble for calling this Morgan's War, or you could go to jail for making a speech saying Wall Street controlled the Washington government. Thank goodness those things aren't happening today. That's one point I did try to make in the piece.
Right.
I've
been, as you've heard, Sheldon, I've talked with Todd Prince about how, boy, the foundations for that kind of thing, again, are being laid right now before our very eyes. The NDAA, et cetera. The stab in the back theory as a basis of domestic policy. That if the government says that the enemy is so dangerous we have to have a war against them, then how can you undermine their effort by opposing it? It's sort of like if you have to have a no-fly zone for East Libya, then you have to have a regime change in Tripoli. It's just one next step kind of so-called logic from their point of view.
And no one can predict what the public response would be to that. It might be very negative. And, of course, that's a calculation that the policymakers would be making before they took any steps. So they might not be willing to take such a step. I mean, why is this your program allowed to be on during U.S. war?
Because nobody cares what I say, man.
Why does anyone? Yeah, well,
I ain't undermining a damn thing, Sheldon.
Why is antiwar.com and many other sites that have...
you're right. Because of the American tradition, not the First Amendment, the American people's tradition of that's the way we like it. That's the answer.
But something has changed, at least in that narrow respect, because if there had been a World Wide Web in 1917 and 18,
right,
we have to assume the government would have stepped in to close down sites. They were arresting authors and speechmakers and barring them for the mails for paper publications.
So of course, the liberal would say it was the federalization of the Bill of Rights down onto the states that accomplished what you're talking about, the change even in the mindset of the people, probably. That, you know, the civil rights liberals in some ways straightened up the Bill of Rights and enforced it on the states in a way where it's unthinkable that they would just shut down a website for being anti-war at this point, at least.
Well, yeah, and I think these stories are always very complicated. I'm sure there were people who observed what went on in the in World War I, the suppression of radical magazines and dissenting magazines, mm-hmm. who you know, might have even been in favor of the war, but just did not like the idea of the government stepping in and suppressing publications. And so that must have rallied the people who were true civil libertarians, even if they weren't not libertarians.
Right.
They still might have been good, solid civil libertarians on things like free, you know, speech, religion, assembly, and press.
All right. Well, now thanks for that previous caller, and I'm sorry, I'll shut up. Let's go to our next caller here real quick before we have to take this break, Sheldon. Hi, you're on.
Hello?
It's you. Go ahead.
I hear you.
Okay. Yeah, I just had a question about kind of the progressive legacy and maybe how aware current progressives are of it. Like, do you think, we know the neocons kind of believe this whole war regimen, you know, as the regimentation of society, and it's a good thing, it's the father of all things, but how aware do you think of, like, Obama is and that kind of the people in the new left as well?
Good question.
Well, I seriously doubt whether, you know, anybody but you know, we libertarians are reading Randolph Bourne these days. I mean, that's the guy to read. Because he's the guy who said to his fellow progressives who published in the same magazines he used to publish in but couldn't publish in anymore, you know, he said, look at the delusions you guys are now laboring under. There's this great quote in the Kennedy book where he says, you who thought you could, you know, you who were unable to stop the war now think that you can direct the war. What makes you think, if you couldn't do the first, that you're going to be able to do the second? And he said, right, you know, a war is like riding a wild elephant. You have no more control of it sitting on the back of the elephant than you do standing on the ground. And he turned out to be right, because there was disillusionment. After the war, some of those progressives said, wow, what did we buy into? This is terrible. They didn't like people going to jail for making speeches. That ran against their grain. They might have liked all kinds of economic planning and stuff like that. But some of them were committed to free speech. I have no doubt that Dewey generally was a free speech guy. So they were unhappy, and they later had disenchantment, disillusionment set in, and they wondered, you know, whether it was a good idea for them to go along with Wilson. That's why I say they were wrong, and Bourne was vindicated.
Right. All right, well, we got one more caller on the line. If anybody else wants to line up, we'll take two or three more in the next segment, too. We're talking with the great Sheldon Richman, Vice President of the Future of Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. The number is 512-271-4836. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, here we are. Welcome back. By the way, I mentioned that article earlier by Anthony Gregory against law enforcement socialism. I just posted that on my Twitter feed if you want to go find it there, at Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with the great Sheldon Richman, Vice President at the Future Freedom Foundation. We're talking about World War I and how it ruined everything for everyone, and even here at home, though it took place far away. And Sheldon, you ready to go ahead onto this next call?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. We're taking calls for Sheldon. Two great ones so far. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Call in and ask your question. Hi, you're on the air now. Should be. Now I click the damn thing right, or what happened? Let me try again.
There I am.
I'm sorry. There you are.
There I am. Hey, Sheldon, I attended the special after sunset caucus for Republicans in Nevada in 2011, and my question is, do you think it's a viable strategy for libertarians to kind of subvert or take over the Republican Party from inside?
I've never had confidence in that strategy. I mean, I remember hearing about it some time ago when people were forming the, what was it called, the Liberty Caucus, Republican Liberty Caucus, and I said, I don't get it. If you're going to climb the rungs of the ladder of the Republican Party, the first thing you need to do is support every Republican candidate, because otherwise they're going to say, well, you don't support the party when you don't like the nominee. So that's not how you get cred right within the party. So what are we doing? Encouraging libertarians to support anybody the Republicans happen to nominate for any office? It didn't make any sense to me. I'm just not confident. I'm not an electoral politics guy. I mean, I used to be involved in the Libertarian Party. From 1981 to 1983, I was the national vice chairman. I don't know how well that's known. I don't try to keep it a secret. But I left the party in 1983, and I haven't looked back, and I haven't voted since 1980 for anybody of any, you know, in any way. I haven't been in a polling booth. So, I think that demonstrates my answer. I have zero confidence in that.
So what then? Just try to break away from the system as much as we can, wherever we can, however we can?
Yeah, generally. I mean, I can't give you a good, crisp alternative strategy. Just because I don't like that one doesn't mean, that I have to settle for that one if I can't think of anything else, right? If a doctor prescribes poison to somebody for some ailment, and you say don't take the poison, it's not an argument to say, well, what should he do, right? I don't care what else he does, but don't take the poison. So I think education and counter economics and all those things, right? Agorism. I'm open to all that kind of stuff. And let people, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom, your famous non-libertarian once said. That was Mao, by the way.
All right, thanks.
Yep. Sure. Well, you know, I mean, well, thanks very much for your call. This is the problem that a lot of people have. I mean, the way I put it is, I don't know what the hell to do. That's why I do this show, because what the hell am I going to do about it? I don't know.
It's sort of a thing where I think we'll
get our way when everybody agrees with us, and the way to do that is to keep yelling at them about how wrong they are about everything all the time, right?
I don't know about the yelling part, but but I see your point, and you do know what to do, namely have this great radio show.
But yeah, it is crappy ripples in a pond. It doesn't have that, you know, make Ron Paul the majority leader of the Senate, and wouldn't that be great? Or make him the Chief Justice, and wouldn't that change so many things? Kind of a thing. Like, I certainly don't have any kind of answer like that, other than, you know, if the Martians come from Independence Day, or from Mars Attacks, I guess, and do away with the Congress for us and give us a clean slate here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Not that I advocate Martian violence, really, but I just mean a world where, I don't know, how about I Dream of Jeannie just banishes them somehow? Does that count as violence if they just, the capital city just disappears? I don't know.
I hope you're not suggesting that Martians aren't people too.
You know, it's an interesting question. If Mars attacks and they bring their kids with them in their flying saucers, it's still okay to blow them out of the sky or not?
Well, but the kids would be dreamers, wouldn't they? They didn't choose to come here.
Yeah, they just want to.
I say let them all in.
Yeah, that's my attitude. All right, well, 512-271-4836 if you want to ask questions for Sheldon. I got another question for you, which is that Are you as convinced as I am that the U.S. government is going for a full-scale invasion of Iraq, only they're going option B, rolling start, instead of option A, build up and then invade, the way they put it in the Downing Street memo?
It does sound that way, doesn't it? What did I read? That who is the Dempsey has already said that they're devising the strategy for uprooting ISIS. Now maybe Obama hasn't yet said okay and let's put it into effect, but they're certainly
not pretty much though. Up. I mean, he said we will deny them a safe haven, which means we won't just not let them be a state. We won't let them be an insurgency.
Yeah.
Which means they'll accomplish what they never did accomplish with the entire Army and Marine Corps there in the years 2003 through 2007.
No, the logic is certainly going to draw them that way unless they totally just turn around and say, no, we made a mistake, and I don't see them doing that. The logic is going to draw them toward invasion. I mean, you got all the authorities on TV, all the so-called experts say, you can't do this with a few airstrikes. You're going to have people on the ground, boots on the ground, like they say. So I don't see how, unless they totally turn the strategy around, they can avoid that. So I guess we're being softened up. There's going to be mission creep. There has been more and more discussion of, the mission has already creeped. It creeped quickly. And
yeah.
So I'm fearing for the worst now. At least it'll take our minds off Iran, perhaps.
Well, I mean, you know, that's actually a big part of the problem is we're going to be working so closely with Iran, which already has their Quds Force there, helping now the Abadi government, before the Maliki government, in organizing their militias and what's left of their army to protect Shiistan. And now America's their air force. Simple as that. America is the auxiliary of Muqtada al-Sadr instead of the other way around. I don't know if it ever was the other way around. But
now,
America's working for the United Iraqi Alliance again.
Let's point out also that this puts us de facto on Assad's side, right?
On
Bashar Assad's side.
Which is better than being on ISIS's side if you have to choose between those two.
Right. I mean, look, I'm no fan of Assad, and I certainly was not a fan of his father's, but it was wrong. I agree with the people, including who's our friend at Spiked Online, who said what boosted what became ISIS was the day that Obama and also Cameron, I guess, declared that Assad had to go, and Hillary too. Assad had to go because that then made it a magnet for radicals who said, oh, good. Hey, we can get in on this now. America's behind Assad going. It also caused Assad to dig in and not in any way try to accommodate the legitimate dissent in opposition in Syria. So it made things really bad. I mean, it turned it into an all-out ruthless civil war on both sides. And of course, like you like to point out so often and validly, the so-called moderates in the opposition didn't stand a chance at that point.
Yeah, never did.
It's going to be Nusra, you know, Al-Qaeda types, and now ISIS, or I guess now just ICE, IS, Islamic State.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Mitchell Prother on the show was talking about, and I wouldn't call this hyperbole. I mean, it seems right to me. He's saying, you know, these guys are madmen. They're like school shooters or whatever. He agreed with Coburn, says they're like the Khmer Rouge, and they're just absolutely as brutal as can be. And based on the theory of relativity, then, you know, al-Nusra's not really that bad. I should find that soundbite of Prothero saying, you know, come on, who could really be that worried about al-Nusra when you got ISIS running around? And yeah, they're sworn to bin Laden, but I mean, these are the moderates compared to ISIS. But moderate compared to al-Nusra? Yeah, there's about 35 of them, and their job is getting weapons from America and delivering them to al-Nusra. We call them the Islamic Front. They're the procurement arm of the al-Nusra front there that serves Zawahiri.
That's right, and it's very dangerous when people make this lump all Shia, Sunni opposition of whatever they happen to be opposing into, you know, they lump them together into one group that, you know, like Netanyahu likes to say, Hamas is like Al-Qaeda, Hamas is like ISIS, Hamas is like, and his spokesman Regev says the same thing, right? They make this comparison. It's got no basis whatsoever. Hamas, you don't have to be a fan of Hamas to acknowledge that it's not ISIS. And it's not even Al-Qaeda, and it's not Nusra. They have a very local grievance. They have not imposed Sharia law in Gaza. They've not attacked the United States. And so to say, well, they're no different from ISIS is just Netanyahu just trying to get the Americans to, you know, uncritically support anything he says.
Right. And I got criticized for comparing Hamas and Al-Qaeda tactics at all. I didn't mean to say they were the exact same thing or anything like that, but there was a comparison to make. But anyway, we're out of time. Thanks so much for your time. This is great. Sheldon, appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great Bye-bye. To have you again. That's the great Sheldon Richman, Vice President of the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. The website is scotthorton.org. And again, I'll remind you, sorry, but it's fundraising week here at The Scott Horton Show. So if you'd like to stop by scotthorton.org/donate, really I need advertisers more than anything, but donations are good too. You can find out all the ways to get that done there at scotthorton.org/donate. And I sure appreciate it. Okay, so now our next guest on the show is Carl Van Wolferen. And I'm sorry, I still didn't pronounce your name right. I did try, though. Dutch journalist and retired professor at the University of Amsterdam. And he's got this great article here at UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. And it's called The Ukraine, Corrupted Journalism and the Atlanticist Faith. Very interesting piece. And we're running it in the Viewpoint section today on antiwar.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Carl?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Scott.
I really appreciate you joining us, and sorry I'm a Texan. I just can't talk Dutch right. I really did try to pronounce it right, but it comes out Carl no matter how bad I try. I even practiced out loud before I went on the air, and no, I still sorry. Anyway, great piece here. I really appreciate your
Thank
work
you.
That you've done, and really appreciate you joining us on the show today. So
Thank you. My
can
pleasure.
We please... Oh, I'm sorry. Please start, if you could, with the news, you know, what you know, and I guess it may be quite a bit up in the air, but could you please tell us what you know or think you know about what's going on in the East as far as these Russian vehicles and Kiev government claims that
well,
they have attacked and destroyed Russian military vehicles inside Ukraine and
what I know is probably the same as what you know, is what we get from the, you know, the news feeds. Maybe I'm not even up to date. I know that these Russian supply, these I think it's 200 trucks that went to the border, and they were searched at the border. I don't know what's happened after that.
Yeah, the government of Kiev has claimed that they have destroyed them at night with artillery, which didn't really sound plausible to me. I don't know if the right sector's got that good of aim or what, but... I suppose it's possible, but I mean that would be a major escalation of this thing if it's
true. I won't comment on that because I have no idea. That last I looked was about an hour and a half ago, and I didn't read anything of the kind. So,
oh, really?
So let us not dwell on that so much. I mean that's really for the wire services or the right. You know the. So, and I'm not really in the news business as such, you know.
Right.
I comment on things, and I talk about things that I think should be our concern.
Right, I understand. It's a much more in-depth piece than simply reporting the news here, but I thought I'd better start with the emergency
sure.
going on. And
sure.
it's Bloomberg
sure.
News has the developing story there. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but for people who want to... Who want to check Google News on that. But yeah, so I guess obviously it's a very complex article that you have here. But first and foremost, can we start with the airplane then? Or I guess secondarily then, can we get to the airplane?
Well, the article, you see, what prompted me to write it is that I was following the way in which what happened was being interpreted in the Netherlands and also in Britain and the United States, of course, and other parts of Europe. And I was struck by the unanimity of, you know, they started pointing their fingers at the guilty party, which was the so-called separatists, and behind them, Putin. And I thought, this is crazy, because it was all based on the flimsiest of, I mean, not even real evidence, evidence that consisted of tweets and YouTube video that and nothing else. So, you know, as a journalist, when something is very big, especially when it's big, and when there is a kind of a consensus forming about what it is all about, and you realize that it stands on very little evidence, you become curious and you wonder, now, what is going on? And so I started looking at this, and I saw that many potential cues were not followed up. I mean, the editors weren't interested in what could have been the cause that would have pointed at the Kiev government rather than the separatists. So I became very interested, and that's when I started writing about this. But I also, I've been following the Ukraine story since the coup earlier, that's in February, earlier then, and what preceded it. And it was very obviously something that was triggered very much with the help of American agents. And it's an example of what we see also on the other side of the globe, which is my area of expertise, Japan, China, and so on. And I thought, this is a big story, because what's going on is vilification of Russia, as on the other side of the globe, vilification of China, a new Cold War, as it were, an attempt to contain those former huge communist enemies. And we should be alert, and there should be neutral reporting on it for us to get an idea of what's really going on in the world.
Right. Well, it turned out, at the very beginning, it seemed like a reasonable assumption that could have been borne out, that the rebels had, maybe they got a missile that was good enough to do it, but maybe they weren't good enough at targeting and they had made a terrible mistake here. It sounded like such a plausible story, but like you're saying, it really hasn't held up. And what seemed like the much more outlandish story, that perhaps actually the government of Kiev shot it down deliberately or accidentally, I wouldn't pass judgment on that, I don't know, but it really does seem to be the other way now, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, you see, when you follow controversial stories, as I have done over the years in India, in Korea, in Japan, in Vietnam, in Southeast Asia generally, etc., you develop hunches, right? And you go on what you know. You have a lot of tested understanding in the back of your mind about what is likely, what is possible, and so on. You form an idea about these things. And my initial response when I heard about this, and I heard, well, who was it, Biden, I think, within minutes of the terrible tragedy happening, already they were pointing fingers at Putin, which was ridiculous, of course.
Yeah.
So I become very suspicious.
Yeah, well, as well you should be, as well as all journalists should be, and that's another major part of the story that you talk about, is the American influence on the European media on this, in sort of announcing really loud, there's a narrative here, and you guys are expected to stick to it, too. They really do fall in line, don't they?
Yes, there's a sad, really a sad side to this European journalism, and it's because the English language media, of course, dominate in the world. And there is no European news source, basically. You have, of course, the French and the Germans have their press agencies, but also they get much of their inspiration and their knowledge from the English language ones. So the editors in New York as well as London have a great deal of influence on what the rest of the world learns about everything happening in the world. And this is certainly true of Northern Europe. So the Netherlands, where I live, is a perfect case in point, And I was reading the paper that I used to work for 17 years, And I was appalled at the way in which they were just copying, parroting what the American media was saying. And, I mean, the London-based media have gone berserk, especially in their leaders, as to what we should be doing about Russia and Putin and so on.
Sure.
And then, of course, there is...
Well, I'm sorry.
There are many
Carl,
factors.
Let me interrupt you here. I'm sorry. We have to take this break. But when we come back, we can talk more about the media and about the Atlantic Alliance and all the anti-Russia narratives presumed to be true by all our media and the rest of so-called civil society on the other side of this break. It's Carl von Wolferen, writer for many major newspapers. Back in a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Website is scotthorton.org. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate if you'd like to contribute. I don't do this all the time, just this week and last and maybe next. scotthorton.org/donate. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right, and so I'm talking with Carl von Wolferen, and he's a reporter from the Netherlands. And he's written for many major papers, a serious journalist here, papers here and over in Europe. And we're talking about, well, the entire narrative, really, of the war in Ukraine, Russian intentions, the shoot down of MH17, and all the related mess, the media coverage, and the relationship between the American government and the governments of the EU, et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole lot of fun. I guess, geez, there's so many different ways I want to go on this. First of all, I guess if we can get back to the plane for just a second, you mentioned an extremely important source, not necessarily definitive, but an extremely important source from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe saying, we're looking at the wreckage and it looks to us like machine gun fire has hit this plane. Is that correct?
I hit the
wrong button on you. I'm sorry, Carl. I do that sometimes. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it was the first member of that organization who was at the site looking at the wreckage, and he spent about a week looking at it, and then he explained this, I think, on Canadian TV, that it looked like the plane was hit by a very strong machine gun fire, and that could have come from a fighter plane that belonged to the Kiev military. Now, that would of course, confirm what the Russian radar reports say, that there were two fighter planes in the vicinity of the plane that was brought down. And also, it would concur with eyewitness accounts that the BBC broadcast, eyewitnesses on the ground who saw it happening, way above their heads, of course. And so, you know, it's the kind of thing that editors should look at. Editors, of course, should wonder what has happened to the radar records of the Kiev control tower. And there are rumors about foreign traffic air controllers being you know, sent out and being fired immediately after this happening. There are so many fishy sides to this story. It's incredible. And if you are an investigative journalist and an editor interested in what really goes on, you would be following them up. And I think that, you know, I told my wife the moment we heard about it, we were returning from vacation and we heard about it in our car driving back to the Netherlands. And I said to her, the truth, perhaps we will never be known because it will be politically determined. And from the looks of it now, I fear that it's going to be the case.
Well, and here's the other thing, too.
We should continue to insist that, you know, we need to know more. We want to know these things.
Well, you know, in American media, that story's already over. I'm not sure. Obviously, it's a bigger deal there in northwestern Europe. But in the United States, they're over the plane. But it sure did help to obscure the major escalation of the war against the eastern provinces.
And it will, the story will come back because, you know, what really is going on, of course, is an attempt by the United States together with NATO. And NATO is an American-controlled organization, even though it's supposed to be, you know, mostly European. And it's an attempt to get closer and closer to a longer and longer stretch of the Russian border to place missile, to Star Wars, but then all along the Russian border, which is extremely dangerous. I am convinced that in that respect, the American side is playing with fire.
Yeah, extremely dangerous is very polite of you to put it that way, what it is that they're risking. And that leads me to the question of whether there's any real split, whether even Germany or any other part of NATO can, are they in any position to resist America's policy here?
That's a very good question, and really that should have our attention, of course. Sometimes I think yes. Sometimes I think there is a, for example, the sanctions in most of these European countries were not at all eager to join the United States in sanctions against Russia. Then this happened, and they felt more or less forced to do this and to join in because there was so little in the way of alternative opinion, alternative news, and so they thought, okay, this is it is only the Russians and Putin in particular who is behind this, and therefore we must do something. And that is what, of course, made them decide a week and a half ago to do this. But nobody likes this, and they realize that sanctions are stupid, and they are, in the long run, a disadvantage to everybody, including, by the way, the United States, of course, because the United States is not working for its own interest at all. It's just, this is another interesting story. Why were they so eager to get this regime change in Kiev? Why are they so eager to go all the way with their Star Wars equipment to the Russian border? Mm-hmm. That's the questions we should be asking.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if the answer is, well, they really thought they were going to replicate the Orange Revolution only even better this time, and they were going to, I don't know, make Crimea an American base, as Putin put it, I'm sorry, we just couldn't stomach the idea of going down there to visit our NATO friends at our old bases in Crimea. That was a bridge too far for us. Is that what they thought they were going to do? And how could they have thought that they would get away with that without provoking exactly what happened instead? The Russians saying, no, thank you.
Of course, Scott, you're perfectly right. But what I think, you know, you have tactics and you have strategy. Tactics, Victoria Nuland, who is the head of this East European desk at the State Department, she is very clearly part of that responsibility to protect people and as neocon-linked characters in Washington who want to do all this. But it is an entity that's out of political control. They're doing their thing. They live their own. That is living a life of its own, like the military industrial complex lives a life of its own. The NSA lives a life of its own. It's not under central political control. Mm. Obama doesn't have control over it. That's how I see it. So you get these people who are going to extremes doing these things, but it is not attached to an overall global strategy that makes any sense.
Yeah, just a bureaucratic, kind of a narrow parochial interest of the actual bureaucrats at NATO.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, this is another thing. NATO, what I thought about a year ago, well, you know, with its disasters in Iraq as well as Afghanistan, where, of course, part of NATO participated alongside the United States, this NATO is way past its sell-by date, and it has no credibility. It's on its way out. But this thing, this coup in the Ukraine has reinvigorated it. And, these military people in Western Europe, they were brought up in Cold War with Cold War rhetoric and everything, and that's what they know. That's what they must believe. But I imagine there is a lot of doubt, and I imagine there's also a lot of disagreement there within the ranks of these outfits. That's what I think. Mm-hmm. And it'd be very interesting to see how this... But it's dangerous. I mean, you can really make a huge mistake. And imagine the situation and look at that from... I mean, imagine you are in Putin's shoes. You have been the object of a vilification, a demonization campaign that's been going on for years, and it's really accelerated in this past half year since the coup in Kiev. And what do you do? What can you do? My impression is he's played it very coolly, diplomatically, and he continues to insist on diplomatic. But at some point, he may feel he has to move.
All right. Well, I've already kept you a bit over time here, but I certainly agree with you with that. It's a scary place to leave it, but I don't know what more we know than that. Then, you know, we could start speculating about the dark future from here, but we'll let it go. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, Carl.
Okay, Scott. My pleasure.
All right. Bye. That is, and I'm sorry I can't say your name right for the life of me, Carl Van Wolferen. Is the best I can do. Here he is at UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, a very well done piece here. It's called The Ukraine, Corrupted Journalism, and the Atlanticist Faith. And he is a Dutch journalist, former professor at the University of Amsterdam, has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Republic, the National Interest, Le Monde, and his career, I believe, was mostly at Hanselblad, one of Holland's leading newspapers. And we'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Yeah, I went over time into that break there for a little bit extra with old Carl. How was I supposed to say it? Carl? I was supposed to emphasize the K-A at the beginning, but I can't remember in the right way, really. Carl. This was Carl. Carol. Carl. It comes out sounding the same no matter how I say it. Anyway, whatever. I'm Scott. This is my show. He's a Dutch guy. I don't have to say his name right. I'm a Texan, god dang it, and I don't have to do nothing. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. And hey, that was cool taking calls for Sheldon earlier. Did you guys dig that? Me too. Well, why don't you call in the show? You can take some calls for me too. The number's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. If you want to talk about, I don't know, whatever you want. Of course, there's wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Iraq, formerly known as Iraq, the Islamo-Fascist Caliphate, Kurdistan, Shiistan. There's a potential nuclear deal with Iran. There was a war breaking out in Missouri the other day, although it's kind of died down a little bit because they died it down exactly how I instructed them to, by pulling back the local cops, replacing them with the state police in slacks and shirts, and being cool. Which they're not that cool, but very cool compared to the de facto martial law that the people were being subjected to for the 3 days before that. And, you know, it's a matter of quality, but I think we're pretty much there where our police are simply, they count as soldiers quartered among us. I think Thomas Jefferson would have had a hard time writing as one of his complaints against the king that, oh, he dresses up his soldiers, his red coats, in blue coats, but deploys them with the same armaments to kill us in our homes and whatever. You think that would have not fit in the Declaration of Independence? If they could have seen this now, it would have been right in the Third Amendment. Or cops, either. And anyway, I mean, domestic policing really like this came later. Yeah. Court marshals before that. I don't mean court marshals. I mean marshals working for the courts were the enforcement before the professional executive police forces. But anyway, professional, quote unquote. anyway, so, yeah, America's a police state. Maybe Missouri particularly, but then again, you know, where I grew up, I live in Travis County, Texas, Austin, Texas, my whole life long, other than a couple of years I lived out in L.A. for fun, and for getting a radio show out there, which worked out pretty well, thank you very much. Coming up this Sunday on KPFK, I don't know. But anyway, where I grew up, the county just north of here, Williamson County, is known as Nazi KKK domestic totalitarian police state, where, you know, preteens and teens are taking their life in their own hands going outside. And they're not just known that way by the kids, not just in my generation, I'm pretty sure it's still going on, the same reputation, but I once worked at a brake shop where the boss there was a retired Travis County sheriff, Austin again. And he warned us, as though we didn't know, that you be so careful in Williamson County. You shouldn't even go through Williamson County. You should go around it. If you got to go to Dallas, go around, which is virtually impossible in any reasonable time. But it, and he said, this was his words to me. Back, say, oh, I don't know, 1996. He said, there's America with the Bill of Rights, and then there's Williamson County, where they're the Gestapo, and there is no law. That was what he called him, a former Travis County sheriff. You know, for 20 years, a career Travis County sheriff who was, like, you know, half retired, managing a brake check. They go under the rules of the Nazi Gestapo, he warned. Keep yourself and your family out of that county. They can. Not that they will do the full nine yards to every resident of the county, but your card could get pulled just as likely as anybody else, no matter who you are. You are not free. And I think that, you know, the Austin police, they sure, like I was saying, they hunt black people for sport. I'm sure that you know, the reputation that APD and the Travis County sheriffs had of being the nicer-ish guys compared to Williamson County when I was a kid, I'm sure those rumors, that narrative never applied to the blacks of East Austin. What, the APD are the friendlier ones? Are you kidding me? When they're almost as likely to get shot by a cop as not on any given day. Well, I don't have a master's degree in mathematical statistics and stuff, but seems pretty risky being black around here. Just read the paper. But so I'm sure it's like that in your town, or at least you know that, oh yeah, two counties over from here. Holy crap, let me tell you some stories about what I heard that those guys did to somebody when they tortured him to death in his cell or whatever it is. I'm sure you got a million of them. We all do. Back to that great video, especially if you're a younger type. In fact, if you're young, you may be way too cool for this. I don't know. It seemed cool enough to me, but I'm not really sure if I'm cool enough to judge. But this guy did this cool video, man. It's called Call the Cops. I talked about it earlier on the show. It's called Call the Cops. And their narrative, the chorus or whatever the hell, the refrain is, this is what happens when you call the cops. And it's all, you know, horrific police brutality. The guy's name is Rob Hustle. FT period live. What does that stand for? Feet? Foot? I don't know. Anyway, Rob Hustle, Call the Cops. And it's great. It'll just bring right home to you immediately. They're like, wow, these guys really are some mean SOBs. And he's got some clips of them in there going through their training where they are just absolutely going through military-style boot camp. Simple as that. They are being turned into soldiers to be unleashed against you. Same as everywhere. That's why in many places, it's policy that the cops do not police their own neighborhoods or their own side of town at all. They police the north side, they live on the south side. They got to have a little bit of, first of all, anonymity so that they can be as unaccountable as possible. They don't want people knowing who they are and where they live, throwing eggs at their door or whatever the hell. And then also, you know, it's the that's their will, but it's the boss's will too, that we don't want you identifying with the people you're policing too much. You know, if your entire attention is on your town, not world events, but just on your life and your town, if you're a local cop and that's your world, then yeah, there's a lot of difference between the nations of north side of town, south side of town. You can be from one side and think of the other side as the other team, the other side of the river, the other side of the freeway, or whatever the dividing line is. And it's a little bit different. They're a little bit less human. They have a little bit less rights because they're the people from over there. And that's, you know, from the point of view of a cop. I mean, ask Austinites. There's a big difference between North Austin and South Austin. They're different. There's a whole movement. Always has been. South Austin secede. It's a whole separate kind of a thing. But from the point of view of a cop who lives, you know, south of Ben White and is up patrolling north of Breaker Lane, he might as well be dealing with the Martians or, you know, the Falugians or whoever. They're not the same as the people in his neighborhood. It's a little bit easier to abuse them. Or do you have a better explanation for why they keep the cops out of their own neighborhoods? Yeah, exactly. My two explanations that make them look the worst are the two best explanations. Wouldn't you agree? Me too. Good. All right. Hell, I wasn't looking at the screen. If anybody called in, I missed it. I don't think so. But you guys can call in if you want. I probably would have noticed. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. We'll be right back in just a sec. ScottHorton.org. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to The Dang Thing here, man. Wrapping up the show for the week. Thanks very much for listening, especially all you people who've helped support and sent in various donations. Again, if you donate $100 or more, I'll send you one of these awesome commodity discs with the QR code on the back so you can instantly check the spot price of your 1 ounce silver round at the point of exchange with whoever for whatever. Free your currency. CommodityDiscs.com, ScottHorton.org/donate, and thanks. And now, Jesus, I have buried the lead all day here. I'm so sorry, guys. What happens is I get so many tabs open. There's so much stuff I want to cover, and then you know how I am. I always end up doing my whole rant and rave on the background, and, you know, with the knowledge of all the stuff that I've read, but without really going through it all, and so point being, I have so many tabs open of stuff that I want to talk to you about that sometimes I completely lose track of the most important thing. In this case, invasion. Okay. You can kick the crap out of me the next time you see me, I guess. It'd be fair. I shouldn't say that. Somebody take me up on it. Iraq escalation. U.S. troops headed back to Fallujah. Having ditched the Yazidi rescue pretext for the new U.S. war in Iraq. Seriously, if you fell for that, it's time to punch yourself in the face 6 times. And scream Hail Mary, upside down, stand on your head, or do something. Step out in front of a bus, maybe? I don't know. Having ditched the Yazidi rescue pretext for the new war in Iraq, after discovering there weren't really many Yazidis to rescue in the first place, and they didn't want to be rescued. Yeah, that's right. Read it at antiwar.com. The U.S. has reportedly set its sights on the Anbar province, site of some of the bloodiest U.S. battles during the previous occupation. In an interview with Reuters, Anbar Governor Ahmed Khalaf al Dulaimi, Ahmed Khalaf al-Dulami. I'm going to pretend that first I in his last name is a silent I, and I'm going to call him Dulami. Anbar Governor Ahmed Khalaf al-Dulami confirmed meetings with U.S. diplomats and senior military officials and secured a promise of not only airstrikes against ISIS holdings in the province, but a military presence on the ground. No date was decided, but it will be very soon, and there will be a presence for Americans in the western area, Dulami confirmed. ISIS controls materially all of Anbar province at this point. Anbar was the first major territorial gain for ISIS way back in January. And now listen up here, guys. So here's the thing, man. There it is. War. Invasion. As we talked about earlier on the show, Obama has said no safe haven. And that means every last Al-Qaeda in Iraq has got to die. Whichever exact militia they belong to, but close enough. Any of the remnants of whatever was Zarqawi's group in whatever form now, all them gotta die, or else America's blank check is still not all the way cashed. We will prevent a safe haven. That doesn't mean we will prevent Al-Qaeda from being the damned government of the West. It's, no, we will prevent them from existing in Western, Northwestern Iraq. What? Are you kidding me? You could drive the entire Iraq war through that mandate. Do you understand? All over again. The whole thing. Oh, look, little Yazidi. They pulled that on you for a day and a half and switched to, yeah, we're protecting Kurdistan. We're protecting Shiistan. And, in fact, we're protecting Sunnistan, too. We're going to regime change and overthrow its new caliphate government and reinstall the Sunni awakening tribes. And there's this great essay about the Islamic State that a guy wrote. I think he's a student and not a professional, but it's really good, where he goes back on the history of the Islamic State from Zarqawi on, which we're going to be running at antiwar.com. I've got to edit it. I'm sorry I haven't finished it. I'll do it over the weekend. I swear I will edit this thing and post it. And it's a great history of the Islamic State there. It's by, what's the guy's name again? Waled Farana. I'm following him on Twitter. Waled, I guess. Waled, Waled. Spelled two different ways. Farana. And, damn, now I forgot which point out of here that I was going to focus on about the Islamic State. Well, anyway, that's okay. Keep your eyeballs open, because probably Monday I'll be running this at antiwar.com. I'll go ahead and change the point to that. Someone was asking me, so wait, America trained this group and backed that group at this time. I said, wait, you know what? That's not quite right. I'll tell you what, read this. This is a great history of how America created the Al-Qaeda threat in Iraq. Remember Dick Cheney claimed, well, you know, that's the sort of geographical center of where this type of extremism comes from. Pardon me? Yeah, you're quite a few hundred miles to the north of what you're looking for there, Dick. And everybody knew it, too. He was lying. But then he made it true by overthrowing Saddam Hussein of the clean-shaven chin and the olive-green fascist, secular, in fact, atheist, self-worshipper, dictator of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and replacing him with lawless jihadistan, the wild, wild west of every wannabe bin Ladenite from 2003 all the way through now. And look at what it's wrought. And I'll say it 1,000 times, because obviously it won't make any good, and so it's going to keep happening anyway, so I'll just keep saying the same thing anyway. The Army and the Marines can't get rid of these guys. The Army and the Marines can kill them. The Army and the Marines and the Air Force, they can blow these guys up. They can blow them up like crazy. They can dislodge them from power Mosul. Hey, Scott, do you think the United States Army could take over Mosul? You're damn right they can. But can they eradicate the Islamic State? Well, here we are after they fought like hell for 2003 against what was called the Sunni-based insurgency, and including Al-Qaeda in Iraq and related groups. They fought against them from 2003 through 2006. And blasted the hell out of a whole hell of a lot of them. And then now, just a few years later, they are now the government. They are the auxiliary sideshow helpers of the Sunni-based insurgency. They are the bosses of all the Sunni tribes in the entire northwestern region now, in all of the Sunni triangle. They are the government. So, didn't quite get rid of them with that full-scale war against Sunni fighting-age males. Widespread sweeps and arrests and killings and searchings of houses and all the craziness that went on in that war in Mosul, Ramadi, Fallujah. And now here we are. So how in the hell is sending the U.S. Army and Marine Corps back going to solve this problem for us? Drive these guys underground and then what? You find the most atheist, Baathist general from the old regime and put him in charge of Sunnistan? I guess that's the most plausible plan. At the same time, they'd have to back the Baathists in Syria, too. You think they're going to do that? Why, I can hear Israel screaming blue bloody murder from here. From, you know, the past, because... Or, well, I'm in the past, they're in the future. Yeah. Well, because they haven't heard me say that yet. They'll have to listen in tonight to their recording, you know, or whatever. So that would at least be a policy that would make sense. But you know what? This is going to be the point I was going to make about the damn tribe that America is invading to put in power. That's the former Sunni Awakening tribe. And the Reuters piece, Waleed Farwana, I follow him on Twitter, and he tweeted me, oh yeah, this is one of those old groups from the Awakening Council years. And I said, well, what would it take for America to... Oh, and he said further that ISIS is hunting down and exterminating across the Sunni Triangle right now. And I said, well, what would it take for America to be able to protect this tribe and turn the tables on the Islamic State? And he said a full-scale invasion. It's too late, man. You know why it's too late? Because David Petraeus failed. The surge failed. Everyone who told you the surge worked, they didn't just tell you the surge worked, right? They said, the surge worked, the surge worked, the surge worked, like cheerleaders at a game. As though just pretending makes it true anyway. Like the girls do when the team is way behind and can't possibly catch up now. And they say, fight, fight, fight. And all the surge did was transfer a bunch of weapons to the Sunni Triangle to be turned against our allies in Baghdad and Kurdistan and to serve as further excuse to invade again. Just like Petraeus' first try at this surge in the awakening in Mosul in 2004, just on a much grander scale. See you Sunday morning on KPFK.